Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. For more than a century, medical training has been centered around the care of individual patients. This is a time, labor, and economically intensive model that puts the emphasis on sick care and less on prevention, for the obvious reason that as doctors, we're trained to recognize and stamp out disease. Increasingly, we've become aware of the so-called social determinants of health, things that have a deep and lasting impact on us, our educational attainment, social networks, housing, healthy food, exercise, and employment, which impact our individual, family, and community health much more so than any individual medical condition. Programs like OU's School of Community Medicine track here in Tulsa, where I teach, are geared toward this newer understanding, and the curriculum being implemented includes elements of public health right in the medical curriculum. Students have opportunities to think more broadly than on the individual patient level and understand how we are all part of a system, our neighborhood and community systems, and how we in the health professions are part of a complex and growing system of care. My guests today, a husband and wife team, are a great example of that type of cross-disciplinary collaboration. Marilyn Winkleby is a professor of medicine at Stanford University, where her background in public health allows her to focus on community-wide interventions to lessen the burden of cardiovascular disease in Monterey County, among other projects. Mike Fischetti, her husband, is a retired oncologist at Kaiser who went back to school to get his master's in public health. He ultimately became chief of preventive medicine and health education at the Kaiser system in California. He founded and directed their hospice program. Both Winkleby and Fischetti are now retired and do more in their retirement than most of us could do in our best years at work. They were visiting Tulsa recently, and we were lucky enough to corral some of their time to interview them here in the studio. Marilyn Winkleby and Mike Fischetti, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm glad you could be here today. I guess I'll start with Mike Fischetti. So we were talking beforehand, and you mentioned the tremendous, what you'd call the new face of homelessness, using as an example Santa Clara County in California, where you're from. Can you describe what's changed about homelessness there?
Yeah. By way of background, about 25 years ago, we worked in San Jose, which is downtown Santa Clara County, and we would describe the demographics of those homeless people as people with substance abuse problems, maybe some mental health issues, and transients. Working in Mountain View, which is a little bit economically better part of the county, we note a big change in the demographics. We see more people who are trying to survive on single income, more people who have been forced out of the tech market after the recession and not able to get back in, less people with substance abuse problems, less people with mental issues. And one of the key demographic or issues is that people who are homeless in our city want to continue to live in our city. And when you ask them, would you like to be housed, 93% say yes. So that's kind of a little bit counter to the usual stereotype, is that people come to places because they want the services, not because they live there, and they really don't want to be housed. They want to continue living on the street.
So in a sense, the financial downturn cast many out as jobs were lost, but it didn't seem to reset the housing market prices or the rental market per se?
Well, our housing rental market is exploding in terms of expense. In a part of the county where there's a lot of tech work, we live in Mountain View, which is Google land. There are a lot of tech jobs coming in all the time. People with good incomes willing to pay higher rents. When the leases expire, rents go up, and the people who could afford there can no longer afford there, and so they have to do something else, and they have to get out. They could try to find something cheaper, which is very difficult. They can double up with a family member, but that might not be possible because those family members might be stretched themselves. They could move out of the county, but then they're changing their whole social and economic connections. Or they could live in their RV or their car or move to the streets.
And Marilyn Winkleby, you had some narrative of some folks that you know who, through your volunteer work, have been forced into homelessness. Are there a couple of stories that stand out to you?
I can say that every person who does not have shelter has a story, and all the stories are different, but there are common threads. The kinds that we've seen most recently is the most common cause of homelessness now is the lack of affordable housing, and this, according to the U.S. Survey of Mayors, would support that. So this is not unique to our county. And so people are long-term residents of a city. They're in fairly stable housing. They're able to make it with two wage earners. And overnight, the landlord comes, and either the apartment is going to be converted to a condominium, or the rent is raised, and suddenly it's $500 more a month. And so it's not like you have time to prepare. Your relatives are stretched, and so the family members already have people doubled up. So the kinds of people that we have seen, we work at a free meal program every Saturday morning where 180 people come. Some are homeless and many are just very poor. Is that there are a number of Stanford graduates. There are many people who are very bright. There are a number of people who have worked for Stanford for maybe 20 years and then been laid off and are now too young to retire, but over 55, which is a little hard to find another job. There has been one man who recently found a job, but he lived in his car for over a year, and he has something like 10 scientific patents and knows much more about science than I will ever know. There is a family that we knew who had three top-achieving students in the Palo Alto schools who were living in a vehicle because of some medical issues. So there are very diverse reasons that are societal reasons or upstream causes, economic, social determinants of homelessness and then poor health or poor living conditions that are really the reasons rather than these individual factors that people look at homelessness and they may say, well, that person is homeless and if they just tried harder and if they just worked harder, by George, they'd have housing, and why don't they do that? Because we tend to look at individuals for having a lot of responsibility for their own futures. And I think it's becoming less likely that you can do it on your own anymore because of the broad income disparities that we have now.
In Santa Clara County, you mentioned previously, has a very wide income disparity.
So we have the distinction in Santa Clara County, which is where Stanford is. It's where San Jose, the third largest city of California, is, of having the largest income disparities or the widest gaps and differences between the rich and the poor of any of the 3,100 counties in the United States.
So you come from a public health background and are on a faculty of medicine. And I wonder, at what point did you make the leap or the realization that social determinants, such as housing, impacted the health of either an individual or collections of individuals or, as you know, as a public health expert, communities?
I might have cheated a little bit because I grew up in a situation that I think I was just surrounded, growing up on a small 2-acre farm in a rural area where you saw lots of things happen. And when I got to graduate school, it was obvious to me that I wanted to be true to my community, to do work where I worked in communities and where my work really focused on health disparities. And so my beginning work was some of the first work that showed some of the distinctions of the associations between low educational level and low income level and poor health outcomes, especially poor chronic disease health problems, which is the main reasons that almost all Americans die.
You called it cheating. I would say almost a head start or an advantage.
Well, I think when you're in a family that experiences a lot of things personally. So I remember once when my father went into town, and I don't know if he had a lot of credit, but he didn't have any debt. And he wanted to get a small bank loan. The bankers wouldn't even talk to him. And here is a very proud man who's always paid all his bills and supported a family, and someone in an organization won't even talk to you. So to me, that was standing there as a little girl seeing something that I didn't quite get that. Why would my father, who was such a generous man, who we fed everybody, we had a lot of people come through our farm who were hungry, for instance, and we always fed them. Or I remember my parents making Thanksgiving dinner, and we would take it out to a barn where a number of Latino workers lived. And so that was part of your fabric, is that you were part of this community. And so suddenly when you saw something where it was discrimination against a family person, and especially your father, and you didn't quite understand it, and yet there was a factor, an upstream factor, really. It was apart from who he was as a person. I think it makes you curious, and that curiosity spills over into your science.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guests today are Marilyn Winkleby, who is a professor of medicine at Stanford University, and her husband, Mike Fischetti, who's a retired oncologist from Kaiser and also is a commissioner on the Health Advisory Committee of Santa Clara County. And Mike, you have had what I would call an amazing perspective on healthcare, both as a practitioner, I guess now retired, but now as an advisor. You get to see firsthand how changes in healthcare policy have affected your community. I'm wondering if you could share with us some stories about folks you've helped enroll in what you'd call Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, get health insurance, and then take them to their enrollment or their medical visits?
So it's always amazing to me through the years to see that despite the availability of Medicaid or even food stamps, people don't sign up. And what's happened now with all the buzz around the Affordable Care Act is that people get interested in the program. So you can actually approach people and find out that, gee, they don't have health care coverage, and they now know that it's a possibility. In our work at the kitchen around the corner from us, we've had the opportunity to come across people who have gotten what I would say less than standard health care, and people with medical issues that are not getting health care. And because there's a social receptiveness now, we can get people to sign up. So I've gotten the trust of many of the people at our family kitchen there, so much so that they will allow me to help them get signed up for the Affordable Care Act, either through Medicaid or the expanded Medicaid or just through the exchanges. And it's very interesting to bring people who have little contact and little sophistication and a lot of reticence to go in. And I work for Kaiser, but I've also brought people into Kaiser. And the people signing up is saying, well, what are you doing bringing all these people into Kaiser? But I think it's a great opportunity now with the buzz about the Affordable Care Act to get people. What's impressed me now since I've been retired and having worked at a system, an organized system, a medical home system, to see how disjointed care and private practice can be sometimes with long intervals between proper interventions that may not be the optimum, and husbanding some of those patients through their medical care. And it's my sincere belief that when medical care gets a lot more organized in terms of accountable care organizations, then people are not going to fall through the cracks the way that they usually do.
You know what it strikes me as? In a way, you're almost a concierge doctor, ironically, for I can see the look on your face is horrified. But in terms of shepherding people through the healthcare system, you're providing that level of service for people who may be mistrustful of the healthcare system or may not are now getting the message that they have the opportunity to get healthcare, and here you are helping them enroll. And then, in fact, it sounds like being an advocate for people who are getting ensconced in the healthcare system for what sounds like chronic medical problems.
So I also work with another organization called Pathfinders, and we have clients who are having difficulty with the healthcare system, either negotiating it or understanding their diagnosis or their own goals or their choices or having the financial issues and so forth. So through this organization, I've had the opportunity to work with many dozens of patients to try to help them negotiate their way. So I would think it a little bit, not concierge, but a little bit more of a navigator, by someone who knows the ins and outs of the system and knows what's missing in their care. You know, some of this is as important as helping people define their goals, but some of it is helping them understand the basics of what their diagnoses are and what their choices are. And unfortunately, in the changes that have occurred in healthcare today, doctors have a lot more responsibilities for recording visits than they have time to spend with discussing with the patients exactly what's going on with them. So it's been a great opportunity to help navigate patients who are having difficulty and who come to us identifying themselves as having difficulty with this group I work with, Pathfinders.
And a number of these people, in fact, the majority of these people, aren't mistrustful of the system. They have medical illnesses now that haven't taken care of adequately, and they're fairly sick, and a number of them aren't even able to get to a physician on their own. And I think the other thing you've seen is a tremendous cost saving. This is going to be through the Affordable Care Act to people that are not going in for emergency care but are now getting systematic care and screening.
The cost-effective approach is interesting and just kind of made me think about one of the approaches that our county had taken to people who are frequent flyers to the emergency room in the hospital, who use the emergency room as their primary care clinic. And they've identified the 1,000 most frequent flyers to the county hospital by cost, and then had an approach to these. And the highest flyer cost about $1.2 million the previous year.
So a lone individual spent $1.2 million, and that was, do I understand correctly, mostly on ambulance rides? Or
no, it was in the ER and in the hospital.
Wow.
Because you can imagine people who are not part of the system, who have chronic illnesses like diabetes, hypertension, strokes, gangrene, and so forth, and they don't get consistent medical care. They've not gotten prevention or maintenance. And so they go to the ER, they get tuned up in the hospital, they get sent out, and then they keep cycling around. So the county took a look at the highest, 1,000 most frequent flyers to ER in the hospital and decided they would do something about that. And starting with the top 100, they decided that they would house these individuals, give them case management, help them with their medical issues in terms of visits, transportation, cost of medicines, and so forth. And this is extremely cost effective. Housing first, case management saves hospitals and ERs millions of dollars. So that's a major change.
So that's the housing first approach.
It's called the housing first, and Santa Clara County is called Housing 1000.
And what was the savings? So if you were able to get the top 100 high users of emergency and hospital care?
In the last couple of years, the savings have been over $5 million.
Wow. So that's...
And that's just beginning.
Now, I'm fascinated by the two of you as a couple, and that is, so you have one retired oncologist who, at what point did you go back and do your master's degree in public health? Was that in the middle of your career or toward the end of your career?
So I went to work at Kaiser, and after 5 years, I was happy seeing oncology patients, but I thought there would be a little bit more to it. So I went back to school, got my mind around statistics, got my master's in public health, had the great fortune of meeting my wife there at Berkeley, and then when I returned to Kaiser, I became the director of preventive medicine and health education, and simultaneously I started a hospice. And I think that for me, it just kind of broadened the concept of what health is. I still enjoyed providing individual care, and I think that was the centerpiece of my satisfaction. But to get involved in prevention, health maintenance, screening, end-of-life care is something that broadened my involvement. And I think after I retired, I think I just kind of broadened the involvement a little bit more on a little bit of a larger scale, working with the county and then working with people who self-identify with difficulties in the system. But I would have to say that my work with individual patients in oncology was still the best part of my career. I enjoyed the detective work, and I enjoyed the schmoozing, and I enjoyed the stories. And I would never have changed that, but my career became a lot broader over the years.
I often find that physicians who have had extensive educational time invested and cost to become doctors wind up, I guess I'm really speaking for myself here, wind up thinking that the repetition of the one-on-one encounter, it seems like you could have more of an impact in the public health field. And I wonder, Marilyn, as someone who came straight in and got your doctorate in public health, do you ever see the converse? That is, do you wish you could work at a more individual level, or are you happy doing the research and sort of the community-wide interventions?
So I think I've been lucky to do both. First of all, I have to say when I went to UC Berkeley, it was my first glimpse of really great education, and it changed my life. And I can't say enough about how higher education is a way to help you do your life work. And so public health to me is community, and it's prevention and looking at the health of the population and keeping that population well. But my research as an epidemiologist, it's data and biostatistics and can be fairly insular. But I had the opportunity to work in a lot of communities along with that. So that was great research because you're working with county health departments. They're very knowledgeable about the community. Community members are informing their work. And then along with that, I was very interested in increasing the pipeline of low-income students to become health professionals. And so I helped begin a program 26 years ago when I got to Stanford to reach out to low-income high school students who are interested in health professions but really often overlooked. And that program is now 26 years old. There have been 600 students that have come and lived at Stanford over the years. They live with 10 Stanford undergrads who are very cool, who look like them, who are just a few years older, who are mostly pre-med. They have hospital jobs. They do hands-on anatomy. They learn about SATs. They learn it's possible to go to college and really have no money. And we have evaluated those students over time. So we've followed 97% of them and found out that 81% graduate from four-year colleges. And of those, half go on to graduate school and medical school. So their success, including a lot of Latino students and some Native American students, has been really phenomenal and I think shown what higher education can do to broadening the pipeline of talented students who are often overlooked and training students to become public health professionals as well as clinicians who often return to their communities to spend their lives in public service and clinical medicine.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guests are Mike Fischetti, who is on the Health Advisory Commission of Santa Clara County, California. He's also a retired oncologist at Kaiser. And his wife, Marilyn Winkleby, who is a professor of medicine and has a doctorate in public health at Stanford University. And Marilyn was discussing her pipeline program that she created 26 years ago and has educated over 600 low-income high school students and given them really the vision to show that they can do it. And you mentioned, Marilyn, 97% follow-up and tremendous 81% of the people, the young people through the program have graduated from a four-year college. And I think you said half have gone on to get either medical or graduate degrees. I mean, that is truly astonishing. So were you able to compare? Was there a sort of control cohort, as it were, to see how kids who weren't in the pipeline program also did throughout those years?
So that's a good epidemiology question, is what's an appropriate control group. So we did one external control group of looking at young people in California who are old enough to have had the opportunity to complete their educations, but young enough not to be in older cohorts where education meant something different, and looked at the expectation of what their final education would be. So these would be 22 to 26-year-olds, for instance, and about of low-income students across those ethnicities that we have, which are low-income white students, Latino, African-American, Native American, and usually immigrant Asian Americans, you would expect about 15% to graduate from a four-year college.
Oh, my goodness. So you're talking about more than a five-fold increase in college
large
graduation.
Increase. Yeah. But, you know, most very hands-on, intensive dose programs like this where students try on medicine, have internships, long-term mentoring, more than just drive-by science, are very successful.
I had a couple of other questions about it. One is the program is specifically designed for low-income children, but you don't take the A students. You particularly go after the B students. And I wonder if you could explain to us why that is.
Because there are many, many talented students who are often overlooked who deserve to be in the pipeline of higher education. And if you're really interested in enlarging the pipeline, you don't keep tapping at the 10 students that are at the top. You say there are 50 students right below them. And those are pretty darn good students. And those students will make it by having the opportunity of the doors being open too.
I would also add that probably there are programs, certainly for those very high-achieving students, right, that scholarship programs or other types of things, and so really aiming more toward this different tier is really powerful. You also shared some statistics about who it is that goes to college in the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. So it's not widely distributed across all incomes, right? The preponderance is the higher-income folks that are going to college.
So if we looked at the top 150 universities and rankings in the United States, which, you know, they are the really good universities, but it goes down to include a lot of the California universities. And if you look according to distribution of family income, 93% are from the upper half. So you only have a 3% chance of even attending one of those 150 universities if you're in the bottom 25th percent of the income distribution, which would be what all of our students are from. What I'd like to say is I think that this area would be a wonderful area to replicate the program.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's a great idea. And we're definitely going to pick your brain to try to make that happen here. One more note about this. You talked, I think, earlier to me about how this impacted your career. This is something that I think was initially frowned upon, this pipeline program, right? I mean, this was something that was a passion of yours to try to help low-income students get some type of mentorship to pull them out of poverty or give them career aspirations or higher education aspirations. And the folks at Stanford maybe weren't so happy about it?
Well, I wouldn't say folks at Stanford per se, but I think many times when you're in a professional role, you have people who are looking towards your career and wanting to help you in that career. And in my career, I would say my supervisors knew that I needed to publish my science. I needed to publish my science in high-impact journals, and I needed to publish a lot. I needed to get grants, and I needed to do really good research. And I think that they felt that this program, which I was doing on my own, but I was really excited about it, would possibly compromise that. And I would say that that's kind of a common, well-intentioned advising. But my own belief is that if you have a profession and you can't follow your ethics and do things that are really going to continue to make you excited and feel rewarded in your career, that I would have left and done something else where I could have done that and I always put my family first. We raised three children. We adopted two children when they were eight from foster care. That was more than challenging for a while. They're now wonderful 31, 32, and 36-year-old young adults, well-employed and making a lot of money in Silicon Valley, actually. and so I think it's really important to say that you want to be able to do work that at the end of your career, you can look back and say, I was true to my ethics and I feel content about some of my work.
Marilyn Winkleby is a professor of medicine at Stanford University. Her husband, Mike Fischetti, is a retired oncologist and on the Health Advisory Commission of Santa Clara County, California. Together, they've spent decades working on public health issues and exploring how poverty impacts health. Well, that's our show for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.